Chip Passanflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we're back again. The glorious 25th of May. Happy Geek Pride Day to everybody out there.
What is that, Steve?
It is the celebration of all the things that I love, Chip. Towel Day from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the glorious 25th of May from the Discworld, the anniversary of the release of Star Wars in 1977, and Alien in 1979. So we've got lots of stuff to celebrate today. That's not what we're here for. We're here to celebrate Chapter 5 of A Study in Scarlet, the first Sherlock Holmes novel.
That's right. The mystery is afoot.
Yes.
So, Chip, what do we learn in this chapter?
Well, we learned that Holmes makes a prediction, and that Holmes is right, and Holmes follows a suspect, and Holmes loses the suspect, and then Holmes is vindicated of his suspicion, but feels very humbled because, you know, you can't be perfect.
Yeah, I like that little bit of humility at the end. Although humility is probably a strong word for it. Now, did you guys notice that the titles in A Study in Scarlet are really different than in other things we've read? These are kind of set up as newspaper headlines, laying out the main action of each chapter. So like yesterday was What John Rance Had to Tell, and today is Our Advertisement Brings a Visitor. So
there's a lot of skill to title writing. There's a lot that goes into that. And yeah, these are very descriptive titles, and that's okay.
Not the adventures of Our Advertisement Brings a Visitor.
But also, this is very typical of Victorian novels, that chapter titles have these sort of like headline feelings to them.
I see. That makes sense.
Yeah. It feels very Victorian in a way that we've gone to a noun phrase for titles in the 21st century. This is pretty typical. Our advertisement brings a visitor. And you guys, I got excited because I love when Sherlock puts out an ad and just has the person he's looking for, just has them come walking through the door. Like, remember in Black Peter, he advertised for a harpoonist, and in walks three harpoonists, two little guys, and the big guy who must have been the killer. And so, you know, it's just, there's something so charming about that, that he can write the right ad. Maybe this is because I'm an English prof and I'm always like, if you write something really well, it'll be rhetorically powerful. And Holmes shows us that.
And of course, in Black Peter, we learn they just pin it right to the wall.
And there's something so timely about this idea of putting an ad in the paper and everybody will see it, because that's what everybody does, is looks at this ad. I don't know what the idea would be in the 21st century for the place that everybody would see it. YouTube?
Like, our media ecosystem is way too big for, I mean, this whole concept, the trope of putting an ad somewhere. It's a tricky one to imagine, right?
In fact, that's very difficult. I mean, companies are finding how difficult it is to, while they certainly can target a specific audience, but sending something out to the general person is very, very difficult. Probably the largest thing we could think of right now would be a Super Bowl ad.
Okay, television advertising is still on the top of that list for sure. I think Facebook is pretty close.
I was going
to
say
though.
Social media too, right? Yeah. Yeah. Now, this notion of putting an ad in the paper to get the person you're looking for to walk into your house instead of running around town looking for them, that actually comes from the very first detective story, Edgar Allan Poe's The Murders in the Rue Morgue, which was published in 1841, so half a century earlier. And you'll remember that Doyle referenced Dupin and the Poe stories. And so I actually, just for fun, because I love Murders in the Rue Morgue, I just think it's a great story, I went and looked at what was the ad that Dupin put. And do you guys mind if I read it? It just made me laugh.
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay, so here's the ad at the end of Murder in the Rue Morgue. Caught in the Bois de Boulogne early in the morning of the murder, a very large tawny orangutan of the Bornese species. The owner may have the animal again upon identifying it satisfactorily and paying a few charges arising from its capture and keeping. Call at their home. And so this is an ad for a large tawny orangutan of the Bornese species. And as I read that, I just thought, oh my goodness, this is totally something that Sherlock would do. You know, like that sort of funny, outlandish, charming, smart ad that brings you what you want, even if it's the owner of an orangutan.
Well, and we learn in this one that there's, you know, writing a good advertising has a good ring about it.
Ah.
The jokes keep coming.
This is a great way to have the story work so that the suspect comes to them. And this works out again here to a degree.
There's a bit of a complication, right?
So as we learn, it's important to have them come to your home because that's where you want them to know. You want them to know where you live, where your office is. That sounds awesome.
Now, the opening of the chapter, Watson reminds us he's still sick. He's still tired. He's convalescing from his war wound. And he is too tired to go to the concert with Holmes. Remember that we left. Holmes is super excited about going to that beautiful violin concert. And Watson's too tired. So then we get into Watson's mind to open the chapter. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw before me the distorted, baboon-like countenance of the murdered man. So sinister was the impression which that face had produced upon me that I found it difficult to feel anything but gratitude for him who had removed its owner from the world. If ever human features bespoke vice of the most malignant type, they were certainly those of Enoch J. Drebber of Cleveland. Still, I recognized that justice must be done and that the depravity of the victim was no condonement in the eyes of the law. Whoa, there's a lot to unpack in that opening. What did you guys notice there?
Enoch is certainly not a very great name.
Well, the name is still terrible. Yes, this is still a terrible name. This is a totally fake name. We talked about that in the first chapter when we got introduced to this name. And Cleveland is certainly a terrible place to grow up. Sorry, all of our listeners in Cleveland, it's terrible. But this idea, once again, of the murder being so much more terrible than anything that Watson saw in wartime, and he saw terrible things that are haunting him already, but this haunts him so much more than that.
And as you point out, Steve, many, many times, baboon-like consonant.
Mm-hmm. Back to that zoomorphism again. Doyle really can shorthand his way into our heads by giving us these images.
Justice must be done. You know, there's certainly some weight to what Watson is saying also.
But I also think it's interesting that Watson doesn't know this guy. I mean, he walks in, he sees him dead, and he thinks, wow, I can tell from his face that he was a terrible person. Can you? Can you really?
You know, it's Victorian. We can judge people on so many levels.
And I guess that's what I'm saying, is that there's this sort of unquestioned, uninterrogated notion that a middle-class white guy can walk in and take a look at a scene and make this assumption about who someone is just based on their simian baboon-like countenance. It's very problematic, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sure.
And he's like, I'm almost relieved that someone, I mean, he says, it's difficult to feel anything but gratitude for him who had removed its owner from the world. He's like, I'm almost relieved someone killed this guy. He's such a creepy guy. You never even met him. You're right. Seeing him, you know, with like a feature of horror on his face. And so it's an interesting, like, it's a morally complex moment, I would just say.
And he doesn't even say that, you know, if you just jump on a ship and go somewhere, you know, as we've learned so many times, it's reasonable.
Right.
Exactly.
That is pretty deep in this short little chapter here.
Uh-huh.
Holmes Wax is eloquent. He says that the concert was magnificent. As he took his seat, he says, do you remember what Darwin said about music? He claims that the power of producing and appreciating it existed among the human race long before the power of speech was arrived at.
And once again, what we're given is there was a concert. It was a real life concert. Darwin's a real life person who was certainly on the public consciousness at this time. Watson and Sherlock are obviously real people.
Yes, the verisimilitude there is great. I also think that there's something really deep about this. I actually went to The Descent of Man last night where this was published and looked up what Darwin says about music. And this is actually an excellent paraphrase of it. But this idea, do you mind if I just read like one more sentence from that?
Not at all.
So Sherlock says, paraphrasing, "Perhaps that is why we are so subtly influenced by music. There are vague memories in our souls of those misty centuries when the world was in its childhood." Ooh, I like that. I mean, that's poetry. This notion that music, and I mean, I love music. I think the three of us all really love music, right?
I don't love music, Pam. We haven't talked about this. I don't love music.
You don't love music?
That's why they bury him in a basement during the summer.
I like really crummy music that nobody else likes.
I like all music, including crummy music.
I like it all.
We'll talk. But this notion, which I believe in, Steve might not, that like music taps into something like underneath language, deeper than language. Music actually, like, it goes to something that's pre-linguistic. And what Darwin said in The Descent of Man is that certainly people had music before they had language. And so there's this notion of like evolution, which is still a new-ish idea. 1889, mm-hmm. Of course, Origin of Species, but still very much a debated idea in 1887. And then there's also that notion of like aesthetics, the power of music to tap into something deep inside of us. I love that.
There's a couple things that I'll bring up. One, as people get Parkinson's and lose control of their body, music still taps into their soul. They can remember the music, the muscle movements of playing a particular piece of music. They can remember the lyrics or the songs. You find it in a number of studies where, you know, people are struggling in certain areas, but music is the one thing that they can still grab onto whatever their past was with it.
Yeah, and music therapy is a really great field. I think a growing field with a ton of promise for lots of different disorders.
Well, we can go into that. We actually have a person across the pond from you, Pam. They do some work at the Carnegie Hall, and that's basically what they're doing. They're working with people with, you name the challenges, the music is an area. It's certainly much more primal than just language.
I think we don't need to go too deep into this, but this goes back to all of my left brain, right brain study and the idea of rhythm and the patterns of life. And I don't know that it's necessarily a primal thing, but I get it. There's a rhythm to things. And we get into the left brain, right brain. Music is the only study that covers both equally, both the mathematical, the time, and the creative.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And of course, as a musician himself, as someone who uses the violin just to sort of focus, but then who can also play beautifully if he wants to, Holmes does sort of, even though he feels very right brain, he reminds us, especially throughout A Study in Scarlet, more than in the short stories, that he does have that imaginative, creative part to his personality. He also is quite sensitive, I think, in this chapter towards Watson specifically. He notices that Watson isn't well. And Watson says he can't believe he's so upset by this murder, given that all that he saw at war. And Sherlock actually says, "I can understand. There is a mystery about this which stimulates the imagination. Where there is no imagination, there is no horror." And I think he's tapping into something so important about detective fiction there, that when we do see a murder, then we are cognitively engaged to try to solve it, to try to use our imagination and our rational skills at the same time to figure out what has happened, as readers, as a detective, as a society. And so he's tapping into like why detective fiction matters, I think.
No, you're absolutely right, Pam. There's a depth to this. There's absolutely a study of all of these ideas of music and of investigative everything and newspapers and publishing. There's so much to this chapter, this tiny little chapter.
It feels like a small chapter, but there's a lot underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
There, of course, is the prediction that comes true.
Well, it does, but Holmes is also fooled at the coming true of the prediction, because he put out this ad that he thought for sure somebody would come to his rooms and be the suspect he was looking for, but then this old lady shows up.
And she's funny, right? And she actually, one of the things I noticed, she introduces a man, her son-in-law, who's a smart, clean lad, as long as he's at sea and no steward in the company more thought of. But when on shore, what with the women and what with liquor shops? And so it introduces that thought that we've had in many of the short stories, right, about men who are perfectly good guys, but who are corrupted by alcohol.
Well, it sounds like that'll come it actually comes true as prohibition eventually comes
exactly
the standard for the time.
So this woman, though, but she's so convincing, she even has this, she even has this statement that we're going to see many, many times. So, of course, that scene is so great where they're just like, oh my gosh, this is not who we were expecting at all. And then Holmes doesn't ask Watson to come with him because Watson's not well. So he runs off to just follow her and see if she's an accomplice. And when Holmes gets back, this is my favorite part. I bet it was yours too, Chip. The instant he entered, I saw by his face that he had not been successful. Amusement and chagrin seemed to be struggling for mastery until the former suddenly carried the day and he burst into a hearty laugh. I wouldn't have the Scotland Yarders know it for the world, he cried, dropping into his chair. I have chaffed them so much that they would never have let me hear the end of it. I can afford to laugh because I know that I will be even with them in the long run. He has chased this woman down and didn't realize that she wasn't an old crone at all.
It's a man, baby.
He's been fooled.
No.
But he can laugh at himself, right? He can laugh at himself for being fooled. And he's like, oh my gosh, you can't tell Lestrade. You can't tell Gregory this, but I was fooled.
So did I catch this properly? He jumped like on the back of the carriage?
Yep, that's an art which every detective should be an expert at.
Oh my God.
So he perches on the back of the cab as it goes off. And then when the driver goes to let the old lady out, there's no one inside.
What? It's a magic trick.
Magic trick that we've seen before in the short stories later on.
Exactly. We're going to see it many times. And when Watson says, well, wait, where did the old woman go? He said, old woman be damned, said Sherlock Holmes sharply. We were the old women to be so taken in. It must have been a young man and an active one too, besides being an incomparable actor. That getup was inimitable. And so one of the reasons I think he's kind of a little jovial about this is he's got a worthy foe, right?
And we know that that is one of the things that Sherlock Holmes really loves, is finding a worthy foe, especially somebody who is good at costumes, disguise, and acting. This is right up his alley.
An actor, Steve.
That's what we need. Gary,
what we need is an actor. Team America comes into play so often in these short stories.
Once a month at this point. Right.
So then we get to the ending, which is my favorite part, because Holmes says, you know what, Watson, go to bed. I'm going to think about this for a while.
Well, what he says is, now, doctor, you are looking done up. Take my advice and turn in. So again, we've got that sort of sweet part of him being the roommate and like paying attention and like taking care of him. I was certainly feeling very weary, says Watson to end the chapter, so I obeyed his injunction. I left home seated in front of the smoldering fire, and long into the watches of the night, I heard the low, melancholy wailings of his violin and knew that he was still pondering over the strange problem which he had set himself to unravel. So, not a very pensive sort of close to this chapter. Now, you know, we've got our rising action, our falling action, and we don't know what's coming next.
Yeah, it's not a cliffhanger like the other chapters for sure. But we get a little more of that relationship between Holmes and Watson developing. Is Watson a partner in the investigation here yet, or is he still just like a roommate?
Well, he definitely is just writing. He's putting down into words what he is observing. But you know, I don't think he truly is a partner in this case as of right now. He's just observing this new roommate kind of doing his job.
It's the observation that's the key to this story, isn't it? That's what the readers in 1887 were getting, was just the observation of this odd Sherlock Holmes character. They might not even notice Watson as a character as such in this.
But on the other hand, Holmes was like ready not to take this case, right? And so when Gregson first came, Holmes was like, why am I even going to do this? They're just going to get all the credit. And Watson's like, come on, you have to help out. If you can, you know how. And Holmes has referenced that a couple of times. Thank you for making me go do this case. It's been great. And so in that sense, he's starting to be part of the package.
But not bringing any of his medical knowledge to it, not bringing any of his I'll bring the gun part of
it. He did. He brought the pistol.
He got the gun out, Steve.
All right.
He cleaned and loaded his service pistol. No, he didn't use it because it was just an old crone. But I don't know. I guess I would put Watson as halfway between roommate and partner, because he did, you know, he went to the crime scene and skip the concert, but that's not really part of the crime. And then brought out his gun for the suspect.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
I don't know.
Certainly early days it for is. These characters. Is. This is certainly character development that we are seeing from Doyle here. Mm-hmm. I hope everybody's enjoying this character development, seeing these chapters. I'm not quite to the, hey, we should binge three chapters part yet, but this was a really short chapter that really led the case on, and I really wanted to read more this morning while we were preparing.
I'm always ready to read more. I'm going, oh, we're having a conversation on just this chapter. I'm like, I'm ready to go. Keep going.
Yep, Netflix versus Hulu, definitely.
Exactly.
I hope everybody's listening out there. Hope you're enjoying it out there. Hope you're having fun on Geek Pride Day, enjoying our conversation. If you have something to share, we would love to hear from you. Send us an email or a voicemail. Give us a phone call. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes and go to our website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com, to find all of these conversations all packaged together for you. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Where's my sandwich? What I want to talk about is what I want to thank you for. What I want to thank you for. It means so very much to me without you. I would never see the light.
I've already figured this one out, Steve. Do you know how? 42.